From London, the National Broadcasting Company presents War Telescope, a review of the war week and a forecast of possible developments to come. War Telescope features Elmer Peterson of NBC's London staff, a veteran reporter of the European scene. And for his regular Saturday report, we take you now to London.
This is Elmer Peterson in London. Here in London, I've just been talking to some American pilots about the rocket guns the Germans now are mounting on some of their fighter planes. We also talked about the new forms of anti-aircraft fire the Germans are using. The comment of these American pilots was very blunt. The German defenses, they said, are tough and getting tougher. It's something that provides new problems, difficult problems. Incendiary anti-aircraft fire, which can set a dozen fires burning on your plane, is no joke. Nor are the rocket guns fired from planes which try to stay beyond the range of the guns on your own plane, lobbing over their shells like trench mortars. What it all amounts to, said these pilots, is that the Germans are making a supreme effort now to get at Allied planes without getting close enough with their own to be destroyed themselves. At any rate, the American airmen over here don't underestimate the Luftwaffe and German defenses. They don't underestimate the ingenuity of an enemy who is by no means stupid and who is concentrating hard now on defensive measures, whereas he once startled the world with his application of offensive tactics. Talk to these American airmen over here, and you'll find them resentful, even angry, over reports at home that the Luftwaffe is finished, at seeing headlines reading, "Where is the Luftwaffe?" The answer to that is the story of what happened at Schweinfurt, Germany, this week, where we lost 60 flying fortresses while shooting down over 100 German fighters. In other words, fly on a daylight raid on Germany these days, like these American airmen do, and you know where the Luftwaffe is. And so over-optimism at home, a feeling that bombing Germany is a cinch proposition now, doesn't help the morale of the boys over here. Now, there's not the slightest doubt among these American airmen here but what they can put it over. No question but what Germany will be defeated. But there is a question, a very serious question, as to how long Germany can prolong the war. First, by desperate defensive measures. And second, by purely desperate measures, which may see the Germans forgetting all conscience and principle. In this, it must be assumed, the Germans have at least the outlines of a working strategy to hold off defeat as long as possible, to gain at least some minor victories in the hopes of regaining some of their lost prestige. So we have the impression here in Britain now of being close spectators in a final race against time in the matter of what the war can produce in the way of new weapons. It's something that may see the advantage temporarily swinging from one side to the other, but with a final advantage always on the side of the Allies. For the simple reason that we can work and produce without interference, without having our factories and research buildings necessarily blasted off the face of the earth. The Germans can't. But it would be foolish indeed to underestimate the German efforts. So far, it's true, the Germans haven't been too successful in their search for new defensive weapons. But they're still trying, and they'll keep on trying. Here in Britain, we're assured that new countermeasures have been worked out and are being put into effect. Flying rocket guns will be mastered, just as the floating magnetic mine was mastered. And German defenses can always be overwhelmed, regardless, by sheer force of skill and courage, as they were in that recent raid on Schweinfurt. At the same time, no amount of wishful thinking can obscure the fact that we must be prepared now to pay a higher price for attacks on Germany. Before this war is over, we're going to see air battles in which heavier and heavier guns will be used, requiring heavier and stronger planes, possibly involving completely new tactics in air combat, although factors of speed and maneuverability and skill will play their role at all times. And the outcome of the coming air battles and air strategy over Germany is going to have its effect on the Second Front issue. In the opinion of Sir Archibald Sinclair, British Secretary for Air, we're now inflicting mortal wounds on Germany through air attacks, with the worst yet to come, and with the strength of the British and American bomber commands here increasing steadily. From such statements as this, one gains a hopeful impression here that a second front across the English Channel may not be necessary. And there's no question but what Allied air chiefs here are out to prove that air power can be decisive. But there's also the question of how long it will take air power to be decisive, in view of what the Germans may yet produce in the form of more effective defenses. And here is where the element of time enters in. Whether air power can be decisive quickly enough, as example, to convince the Russians that everything possible is being done, and thus get from the Russians a full and fundamental agreement on military and political strategy. It's stressed here that Allied air power is now doing a tremendous amount of damage to Germany at relatively low cost of human life. The Russians won't disagree with this. The Russians are, however, determined to get the war over as soon as possible. So there's a growing opinion here that a second front may come about before too long. Not because Germany can't be defeated in time by air attacks, but because the circumstances of agreement among the Allies demand such a front. Because the need of finishing the war as soon as possible makes it necessary. It's a point that's going to be raised strongly at the conference table of the Tri-Power meeting in Moscow. The Germans, remember, lose either way. The more they defend against Anglo-American air attacks, the more they encourage the demand and necessity for new land fronts, which in turn spreads their defenses. But then the Germans are concerned chiefly now with making a victory out of their inevitable surrender. Their scramble for new weapons isn't only to defend their cities and industries, it's to confuse also the Second Front issue. When that Second Front does come, we must expect extensive casualties among our armed forces. But one thing will be certain, as one sees it from here. Our wounded in this war have a far better chance for recovery than ever before. They're being saved on the battlefield, and they're being restored behind the battle lines at hospitals where modern medical science finds full expression. Here in Britain, I just paid a visit to one of the greatest hospitals in the world, the Queen Mary's in the outskirts of London. It's an enormous place where skilled physicians are busy rehabilitating men and women who have made their war sacrifice in terms of physical hurt and injury. A hospital famous for its advanced research, where soldiers, sailors, and airmen are being provided with artificial legs and being taught to walk on them, where they are getting artificial arms and being taught to use them, where the wonders of plastic surgery are being demonstrated every day, and where, above all, these men are being helped to regain confidence in themselves as well as complete efficiency of movement. To visit this hospital is to gain a personal lesson in humility. You'll find yourself wondering what the patients at a hospital like this think of all the struggle and rush and confusion with regard to post-war advantages, all the high talk about return to normal, while they work to rebuild themselves before they can even think of joining in the task of rebuilding other things. But you also come to marvel at the remarkable things being done here in Britain and elsewhere in restoring war wounded to normal living and normal thinking after their trials and sacrifices on the field of battle. Here in the spacious grounds and buildings of a British government hospital, you find full evidence of what modern medical science can achieve these days. In the space of 2 hours, I saw things which I would not believe had I not seen them. I saw a British soldier who had lost most of one arm in Libya. I watched him swing a pick with all the skill and strength of a man with two good arms. I watched other men ride bicycles, play tennis, drive automobiles, perform all manner of skilled work with the use of artificial legs or arms or both. I talked to a man who works all day standing up and who rides a bicycle 26 miles each day and getting to and from his workbench. It was unbelievable in its way to learn that he had an artificial leg. After seeing all that, I found it easy to understand how pilots are going back to their planes to carry on as efficiently as ever, undismayed and undeterred in their sense of duty by the fact of having lost an arm or a leg. Yes, you can see and hear amazing things at a hospital like this in Britain, things which make you conscious of the responsibility of governments toward war wounded, things which make you realize that this responsibility is known and accepted. I talked with an American pilot who lost both legs in North Africa. I found him in his wheelchair after he had finished some of his first tryouts with a pair of artificial limbs. He was not depressed. He was not sensitive about his condition. He was healthy with confidence and a new ambition, the ambition to get walking again quick, so that he could get back into the thick of things. He talked of flying again, and he held out his two hands. "Nothing wrong with these," he said. "I want to get back to doing something." He went on to explain that he could have been sent home, but that he didn't want to waste time going home, not while there were so many unfinished jobs still left in this war. There you have courage of the deep and lasting variety that will never lose its value. But the responsibility for men like this does not end with the government. Because of medical science, both on the field of battle and as applied in hospitals like Queen Mary's here in Britain, we are not going to have as many people invalided for life out of this war. There is full reassurance on that point for everyone who has reason to dread that thought. But there will be men and women who will ask that they be treated not as crippled, but as sound and efficient human beings. There's a man at Queen Mary's Hospital who asks nothing more in life than to have this simple point recognized and accepted by everyone. He is Dr. R. Langdale Kellum, chief limb surgeon, the world-famous specialist in this. During the past 20 years, Dr. Langdale Kellum has had the leading role in dealing with some 50,000 cases of people who have been provided with new arms or legs, along with other surgeons and specialists who work with the British Ministry of Pensions under the direction of Dr. W. Hayward, Director General of Medical Services. Dr. Langdale Kellum's own experience now has international application. His formulae are simple and understandable. Anyone can fit a new limb, says this outstanding surgeon, but you've got to fit the man's head as well. In fact, the psychological factor is responsible for 50% of success. What we must do with wounded soldiers is to make them normal in appearance and normal in activity. That means they will be normal in mind as well. When you talk with Dr. Langdale Kellum about this, you realize that the days when war wounded struggled about on crutches, when they had to be dependent on others, are gone, provided you, who are listening, will take the right attitude toward them. Modern medical science can put them right, give them back their efficiency. But this is only half the battle as long as you regard them with open sympathy, as long as you keep regarding them as needing sympathy, thus making them conscious of their loss. Employers have a special obligation and responsibility in this respect. They must get over the idea that a man fitted with an artificial leg or arm is only good for certain kinds of work. They mustn't ask, what can't you do, as though the man like this is asking for a favor, when all he wants is a chance to do as much as anyone else. They must ask, what can you do, and mean it just that way. What I want the whole world to know, says Dr. Langdale Kellum, is that the public attitude toward men and women who have lost an arm or a leg must be changed. To continue to regard them as crippled is contrary to all facts, and contrary to fundamental decency toward our fellow beings. In my own experience, I don't know of anyone, he continues, who has not gone back to work in this war after being properly treated with artificial limbs. Of 21 British women who lost arms in the Blitz, 17 have long since gone back to normal household duties or to continue the work they were doing. All have returned to an active life. There are difficult cases, to be sure, continues this doctor, but very seldom is it impossible to restore the patient to some degree of efficiency. So let us think, he adds, of their ability, though disabled, not their disability because they are disabled. This is a message that needs to be heard now as we come nearer to victory and the return of people to normal life and living. Meanwhile, all allied governments, including our own, are studying the system and organization used by the British Ministry of Pensions in dealing with war wounded. It's a vast affair. In addition to Dr. Langdale Kellum's limb-fitting section at Queen Mary's Hospital, there are 16 substations for the same purpose throughout Britain. The basic idea is to concentrate all these patients in order that they can gain confidence and inspiration from each other. It's a different system from our own in the United States, where treatment is far less specialized. The largest manufacturers of artificial limbs, the outstanding being J.E. Hanger Company, which began in Britain as an American concern, are under direct contract to the British Ministry of Pensions. Quality is the only consideration, regardless of what the patient can afford to pay. And so the great work of rehabilitating wounded goes on here in Britain, with its enormous responsibility of seeing to it that our wounded get their deserving chance. It's a responsibility that must under no conditions be forgotten. But merely providing money and medical skill is not enough. Upon all of us rests the responsibility of the right attitude toward the men and women who are leaving war hospitals to find their place in society. A thoughtless remark, a thoughtless gesture, can strike a cruel blow at the confidence of these men and women, their confidence in themselves and the future they deserve. To remember that is the least we can do as a measure of our appreciation. This is Elmer Peterson in London, saying goodbye on this program until this time next week.
You have been listening to War Telescope, a weekly report on the war as seen from London by Elmer Peterson, NBC's veteran observer in the British capital. Mr. Peterson is presented each Saturday at this same time over most of these stations. This program came to you from London and New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.